This is number 0059, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0059. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Peter Geiger, publisher and editor of The Farmer's Almanac. What does The Farmer's Almanac represent in today's world?
What I think the almanac is trying to do in this day and age is help people live better quality lives, do things with less and be more fiscally responsible for themselves, be good to the earth, and then I think share ideas and share stories. And that's what I think the Almanac is really all about. It always has been about that.
T. Marie Benchley is the author of Once Wicked, Always Dead. She is the fourth generation of Benchley writers. Her father, Peter, wrote Jaws. Was there any doubt that she would end up in the family business?
None. You know, it's just been really a natural thing for me. I kind of had to get a little more seasoned in life. I used to write a lot when I was younger, of course, and always enjoyed it. It's very therapeutic for me, and it's just, you know, after 100 years of male authors in my family, it's just time for a female perspective, so I'm happy to take those reins and run with it.
Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and on this edition of Book Banter, we'll look at an artistic mystery that takes place in Paris during the 1920s, plus other books about the lost generation, which is all à bientôt on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, including, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0059, was Scott Neary, who is an actor and an amazing juggler, although he wants me to call him a professional player person. He's been a guest on the show, plus he also helped me with the front page of my website, which is thestufffile.com. Take a look at it, and you'll see some of Scott's work. Thank you again very much, Scott, for doing that for me. And you can check out his website, by the way, at JuggleGood.com. That's www.JuggleGood.com. And thank you, Scott, for doing this week's edition of the Stuff File Slate. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Okay, in July, the prominent BrewDog Brewery in Aberdeenshire, Scotland, began producing the world's strongest and most expensive beer. It's called The End of History, which is 55% alcohol and sells for £500. That's $780 US a bottle. As if to enrage both the anti-alcohol and animal welfare activists at the same time, BrewDog released the first 12 bottles taxidermically inserted inside the carcasses of roadkill, seven ermines, four squirrels, and a rabbit. Said company founder James Watt, BrewDog aims to, quote, elevate the status of beer in our culture. There you go. Now, those of you who listen to the old radio show know how we used to enjoy a good truck spill every now and then. We haven't had a good truck spill. We haven't had any truck spills, actually, to talk about in the last little while, but I found one this week. A load of mayonnaise falling off the back of a truck in Japan caused an 8-vehicle pileup, leaving 3 people injured. The accident involving a motorcycle, 2 trucks, and 5 cars closed part of a 2-lane highway for 5 hours in Hyogo Prefecture. None of the injuries were serious, and now, according to witnesses, boxes filled with bottles of mayonnaise fell off the back of the truck. According to a police spokesperson, what probably happened is that cars traveling behind the truck squashed the bottles of mayonnaise, spreading it out on the road. The sauce's ingredients of eggs, vinegar, and oil mean it is more slick and dangerous than snow. Police are now searching for the truck driver. I guess they couldn't pass the mayo. Meanwhile, in Wichita, Kansas, police say whoever stole a Little Debbie delivery truck apparently couldn't resist helping themselves to the truck's contents. They left a trail of empty boxes and snack cake wrappers after abandoning the vehicle. The truck was taken around 4 a.m. from outside a Walmart store because everything happens outside a Walmart store. What doesn't happen outside a Walmart store happens inside a Walmart store. Police are still looking for the thieves, so at this point it appears that they did indeed have their cake and eat it too. New Hampshire teenager Kyle Dubois was critically injured in March when, during an electrical trades class, he and fellow students attached clamps to his nipples and plugged it into an electrical cord. I gotta tell you right now, this guy came dangerously close to being the idiot of the day, but no, he's not. Anyway, Dubois suffered permanent brain damage, and in August, his parents sued the school district and the teacher. Still in fun with electricity, as an alternative to the surgical scalpel, zapping a penis with electricity can produce a cleaner cut and with much less blood, according to a team of doctors from the Institute of Biomedical Engineering in Taiwan. Best of all, their July report noted that since the experiments were too risky for ordinary test volunteers, they performed all procedures on themselves. Okay, we often hear that doctors are sometimes, you know, really high on their talents and almost think of themselves as God. You gotta have a real big pair, if you know what I mean, to think that, yeah, I can try this on me. I can't do any wrong. Sure. Nice going there. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, here on the Stuff File, in Cheyenne, Wyoming, 34-year-old Brian Mattert thought there was a good possibility police would use a taser on him when they showed up at his house just after midnight on September 16th. So he went in the back room of his house and hastily covered himself in white latex paint. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Responding to a domestic violence call, sure enough, officers Joshua Thornton and James Womack arrived with their tasers drawn. Brian then said to them, "You see all this water-based paint? You shoot me with that, and you'll kill me." The officers demanded his surrender and assured him that the paint would not affect a taser's capability, nor would it cause his death if used. After some time, the officers were able to get Brian into his yard, in the backyard, but then he tried to pull away and was subsequently tased. As he lay in a fetal position on the grass, he still refused to give up his hand so he could be placed in cuffs, so he was tased again. He then went quietly and was booked on charges of domestic violence, assault and battery, interference with a police officer, and aggravated assault on a peace officer. You know, very little knowledge of science is a dangerous thing. Let's get to our first guest on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. You know, published since 1818, the latest edition of the Farmer's Almanac is now out. Every year, millions of faithful readers seek out the down-home wit, wisdom, and proven advice that has made the Farmer's Almanac a household name. On the line with us right now is Peter Geiger, the publisher and editor of the Farmer's Almanac. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Peter. How are you today?
I'm doing okay. It's nice to have you back on our program with us. You were on the old radio show with us over the years, but every year, like I said, the new Farmer's Almanac comes out, both the Canadian and American editions. And since we're doing this show in a new media format, I'm curious to know, because I know you have a very popular website as well.
Yes.
How has new media, if in any way, shape, or form, changed what you guys do?
Well, obviously, we're limited to doing our weather for the United States and Canada, so I can't do it for the rest of the world. But I frequently get emails and comments and sometimes calls from people in different countries who want to know, can they use the planting calendar? Can they use some of the information in the almanac? And then the answer is obviously yes. It doesn't matter what part of the world you're in. As long as you can grow something, you can use the gardening calendar. And obviously, the wit and the wisdom. And I had a gentleman in Russia wanting to know how to make an apple pie. There was a recipe in my almanac, and he wanted to know what shortening was, so I told him what shortening meant or what a substitute would be, and he used that. So what I think what it's done is, rather than just be an American or a Canadian publication, it has become something of a worldwide phenomenon. People have heard of the Farmer's Almanac. There are people all over from North America that live all over the world or traveling around the world, and I think that the new media has allowed us to reach people that we might not have before, and my website, which is farmersalmanac.com, allows people to see what they might see in the book, and if they can't find the book, they can at least see portions of it on the website.
Now, how different are the Canadian and American versions, besides, of course, the localized weather?
Well, the Canadian, there's at least probably three Canadian stories that are uniquely Canadian with Canadian writers. And but when we're on our conversations, a lot of what we talk about is in both almanacs because, quite frankly, no matter what country you belong to, the same things are of interest. You know, for example, we have a story. Last year, everybody was concerned about the H1N1 flu, and this year we have a story about 10 things you can do to build up your immune system. So you know what? Maybe you won't even get the flu. We have the invasion of bugs, and that's an issue no matter where you live. And so whether it's bed bugs or other kinds of insects that are invading your house, we tell you how to get rid of them or what to do about it. And just a lot of good practical advice. And then I have a story this year about friendships. And we have so many Facebook friends, but we may not have as many really good friends. So I have people going to farmersalmanac.com telling me about their friendship stories. And if you're selected, we mail the friends friendship bracelets. And so what I think the Almanac is trying to do in this day and age is help people to live better quality lives, do things with less, and be more fiscally responsible for themselves, be better, good to the earth, and then I think share ideas and share stories. And that's what I think the Almanac is really all about. It always has been about that.
Now, as you mentioned and alluded to earlier, one of the things that's always been very popular about the Almanac is the weather forecasting. And I guess one of the questions people are asking on both sides of the 49th parallel is, will it be Snowmageddon again?
Well, what we think is that the western part of both countries is going to be milder. We think the middle section of the central plain states and the Great Lakes, and certainly in that portion of Canada, is going to be the heavy snow and cold weather. And we think that the east coast, the maritime provinces down through Maine and down to the Florida, is going to be pretty darn cold. We're saying bitter cold, probably average amounts of precipitation. And of course, that varies depending on where you're living. But if you know what your average is, I would expect at least the average. But I think the worst of the worst is going to be in that middle section of the United States and Canada that'll get the cold and very, very snowy conditions.
I mentioned published since 1818. You know, there are so many famous magazines and publications of all types and sizes that have come and gone, yet the Farmer's Almanac is always around. It's a perennial. What makes it so that you guys have managed to survive all these years?
Well, I think the fact that it's an annual is probably helpful. You know, we're not every week trying to put out another publication. I think there's a lot of respect that over the years, you know what, the Almanac really was a guide to living, and it's helpful. I mean, it's only good if it's useful to you today. And 100 years ago, it was useful to farmers. Today, it's very practical, and we're giving people great suggestions on how to live their lives. And there's this trend now to growing your own food because there's so much tainted food from coming from different parts of the world. There's a great deal of interest in fishing and hunting and observations, and then there's just kind of fun stuff. We have a story about products that were really, really important in our lives maybe 20 years ago, but you know what? Today we don't use correction fluids because we're not typing anything. We don't see women in stores with curlers as they once were, and there used to be sifters because flour would get all gunked up so you had to sift it. Well, you don't see those anymore. So, you know, sometimes you step back and you say, wow, in 20 or 30 years, there's a whole bunch of things that we don't use. And I'm sure in a few years there's some things we're doing right now that we won't be using.
But by the same token, looking over the years that you put out the Farmer's Almanac, do you find that there are some things that are cyclical, some things that we perhaps haven't done for several years that we're coming back to? You talked about people growing their own food, for instance.
Sure. Well, I think, yes, very much so. I think that people are much more interested in raising their own food. I'm not talking about big, you know, maybe doing tomatoes and carrots and a few basic things. But I think people are much more interested in growing their own food. There's a big trend right now towards having your own chickens in your backyard and having your own eggs. We have a little feature on some of the trends in gardening, and one of the trends is actually slow gardening. Rather than trying to cram as much as you can out of a little piece of soil, taking it a little bit easier, and actually even growing, if you just have a balcony and you live in a major city, how do you grow certain kinds of foods even in a little container. And I think that I think things do come around over time, but I think the fact that we got to be more frugal, we don't want to waste because there's not as much to waste anymore, and we want to get the biggest bang for our buck. I think it's all very common to all of us today, no matter where we live, and really no matter how much money we have, any of us have. You know what? It's just good to be practical about lives, and I think that's what the publication is. And I should point out, too, that our almanac has got an orange and green cover because there's maybe four or five almanacs in stores, but we're at the Farmer's Almanac, orange and green cover, and I have a website, farmersalmanac.com, and love to have people communicate with me. People, perhaps, that are listening to your show, I'd love to have them send a question to me or talk to me about what's of interest to them.
Now, you talk about the fact that some things are cyclical. Have you ever gone through the archives and, you know, I don't know if you've ever written a story about buggy whips in the years gone by, but have you ever seen something in an older issue of the Farmer's Almanac and all of a sudden you say, oh, gosh, that's relevant again?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it's so relevant to the end, but I remember we took The Art of Kissing from 1896 Farmer's Almanac and we published it in 1996. This told you how to behave and how to hold the woman and how to kiss, and it was very dramatic. But back in 1896, we were telling people how to kiss people properly. And then there was another story about what was proper behavior for a child addressing an adult back in the 1950s. And so we replayed that just to show you how far we've come, but in some ways just to tell you how nice it was at one time.
Well, there's always a lot of fascinating information held within the pages of the Farmer's Almanac. And again, we'll mention it's the orange and green cover that we're talking about if people go out and take a look at the Farmer's Almanac in stores. But again, you've mentioned a couple of times the website, which is www.farmersalmanac.com. Anything else in particular that you want to mention about the website for our listening audience?
Well, no, just that it's very interactive, and I have blogs on it. I talked about, in the middle of July, I was talking about how all these acorns were falling and that this could be a sign of a hard winter. And then I've just been inundated. As many acorns have fallen at my house, there's been that many people who weighed in on their acorn situation. There's some 20 signs of a hard winter. And so I really like it when people go to our Facebook, go to our website, my blogs, and communicate with us for what they're observing and what they like about what we're talking about.
And where can people find the, as I like to say, the dead tree edition of the Farmer's Almanac?
We should be in every major store that sells magazines. I know we're not, but you shouldn't have to look very far. If not, go to my website again and click on shop and you can get your own copy. We send it out the very same day.
Excellent. That's the Farmer's Almanac, and the publisher and editor is Peter Geiger. And Peter, I thank you once again for being on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter. Enjoyed.
Peter Geiger, the publisher and editor of the Farmer's Almanac. You can check out their website at farmersalmanac.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0059, and you'll find links to their website.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to T. Marie Benchley. She of the famed Writing Benchleys, and she has her latest book out called Once Wicked, Always Dead. Plus, speaking of books, Stuart Nolman and another edition of Book Banter coming your way. And of course, an idiot of the day. Stick around right now, more stuff right here. And this next story comes in by the way of The Darwin File, because as you know, folks, the tree of life is often self-pruning. Okay, you're not supposed to laugh, but this is deliciously ironic. 62-year-old Jimmy Heselden is a British millionaire businessman who owns the firm Segway. Well, he was found dead at the bottom of a cliff with one of the two-wheeled electric scooters near his body. There wasn't a yikes sign anywhere, by the way. Just thought I'd toss that in. The incident, described as a freak accident in the media, no kidding, was not being treated as suspicious. Heselden, a former miner who left school at the age of 15, became a wealthy businessman donating millions of pounds to charity. Now, just last month, he gave 10 million pounds, or $16 million US, to a community project which helps disadvantaged areas. Media reports say Heselden was one of Britain's richest men, with a fortune that put him at around 166 million pounds, or $260 million. I'm guessing sales of the Segway will now plummet, much like he did. Okay, did you just roll your eyes when I did the punchline to that story? Yeah. Okay, the next time you do that, or perhaps the next time you're in line at the grocery store and you roll your eyes at the person with two carts full who decides to use the 10 items or less line, you might be in trouble with the law. That is, if you live in Elmhurst, Illinois. Officials of the Chicago suburb are looking into finding a way of putting an end to the practice by legal means. I'm not kidding. This chaos stems from a recent city council meeting where an Elmhurst resident was ejected from the room after rolling her eyes in reaction to something that was said by a council member. So now, the city council wants to make eye rolling a disturbance and disorderly conduct violation. Because apparently, I guess they ran out of other things to legislate in Chicago, because I'm guessing everything's running smoothly there. Yeah. As for the city attorney, who is slated to report back to the council, he says it's doubtful that in any way eye-rolling could be punishable as an offense with a fine. But then again, that's what he's saying. I thought it wasn't possible for some idiot to come up with a cockamamie idea to make eye-rolling against the law. It's your eyes. They're in your head, but I digress. On to Westminster, California. Authorities in Orange County are searching for a burglary suspect found nude under a bed by a homeowner. Westminster police said the suspect repeatedly apologized and put on his pants after he was discovered. The man told the homeowner he was on drugs and ran from the house shirtless and wearing khaki pants. The homeowner told police he discovered the stranger when he heard rustling sounds coming from under the bed. Police determined the suspect got into the house by using a ladder found in the side yard to climb through a second-story window. Meanwhile, back to Illinois. This story takes us to Skokie, Illinois. 21-year-old Carlo Frank Setecase was arrested after, dressed as a ninja, he allegedly strolled through the Westfield Old Orchard Mall department store for several hours in the dead of night, stealing more than $30,000 worth of merchandise. Now, Frank worked as a switchboard operator in the mall and was charged with felony theft, according to a police report. He was filmed by the store surveillance cameras walking through the mall wearing a black top with a gray hood, a ski mask over his face, black gloves, black shorts, and black socks without shoes. After returning to his hiding place, he was discovered by a janitor at around 2 a.m. and told her he worked at the mall and was staying there because he had family problems and did not have a place to stay. He later told police that criminal activity portrayed in the television shows The Sopranos, Dexter, and Breaking Bad influenced him to commit the theft because the characters on those shows commit criminal acts and always got away with it. Really? Come on. I mean, dude, On TV, the coyote always drops hundreds of feet into canyons on a regular basis and lives to chase the roadrunner another day. You want to try that one too? Really? Here's another person who came dangerously close to being this week's idiot of the day. But he's not. Moving right along. We have zero tolerance for this type of thing. That's the quote declared by James Berg, New Jersey Superintendent of Schools Gail Verona. And you know, I love stories that deal with the idiots who go too far with zero tolerance, and this one is certainly a keeper. Officials at Grace M. Breckwedell Middle School called Patrick Halpern to come pick up his 11-year-old son because he brought a weapon to school. A cigarette lighter the boy found on his way in. Since when is a lighter a weapon? Halpern asked, pointing out that some teachers have lighters. It depends on your whole interpretation of what a weapon is, Verona says. A lighter is not a weapon as a knife is a weapon, but a weapon is anything that has the potential to cause harm. Well then, it's official. Apparently Superintendent Verona is a weapon. I rest my case. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our next guest. Two men both wanted to be the first to a residential yard sale in Sonora, California. That's according to the resulting arrest report by the County Sheriff's Department. John Jocelyn, age 70, was apparently upset that Joseph Brown, age 64, was ahead of him in a driveway and allegedly tried to trip Brown twice. Brown pushed Jocelyn away, and Jocelyn grabbed a 5-pound cast-iron cornbread pan from the table and whacked Brown over the head with it, according to deputies. Jocelyn was charged with assault with a deadly weapon. Actually, a cast-iron cornbread pan usually isn't a deadly weapon unless there's cornbread in it. What did the person who was having the yard sale say when this happened? Did he look at the guy with the cornbread pan in his hand who was just swinging it wildly at another guy's head and said, that'll be $5, please. Yeah. Anyway, let's just get to our next guest, shall we? On the line with us right now is T. Marie Benchley. She is the author of a new book called Once Wicked, Always Dead. She is also the daughter of the late author Peter Benchley, famous for writing Jaws, granddaughter of Nathaniel Benchley, and great-granddaughter of Robert Benchley. Hello, T. Marie. How are you?
I'm good, Peter. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Now, I'm sure if people out there don't necessarily know your work, they certainly recognize that very famous last name. You come from a long line of writers. Was there any doubt that you'd go into the family business?
None. You know, it's just been really a natural thing for me. I kind of had to get a little more seasoned in life. I used to write a lot when I was younger, of course, and always enjoyed it. Very therapeutic for me, and it's just, you know, after 100 years of male authors in my family, it was just time for a female perspective, so I'm happy to take those reins and run with it.
Now, the story you're writing deals with, there's a psychopath in it.
There is. It's very naughty.
What kind of research, if any, did you do in coming up with this particular story?
Oh, my gosh. You know, it's really funny because a lot of people ask me that. I did absolutely no research when I wrote this. It was all about having fun. And for me, what I do is I don't develop the characters. I give birth to these characters, so I know them inside and out. And just like real people, they interact and react amongst themselves. And I'm basically just there. It's like a movie reel that plays in my head, and I'm able to basically just record what's going on in their lives. A lot of people have asked me, well, how did you ever come up with that serial killer? And it's kind of a really funny story, but I'll let you into a little insight. I hope she's not listening right now, but I'll let you into a little inside secret here. I was in my writing room, and I was working on Once Wicked, Always Dead. And for me, I just didn't want it to be a romance novel because it would have been too boring. I need spice in my life. So I was writing along, and I had this lovely neighbor who was walking by, and she happened to have on a Superman T-shirt, and she was walking her dogs. And she has this, like, really loud cackle, laugh, and she started laughing, and it just popped in my head. Oh my gosh, that's what I need. I need a sociopath in my book. And so the t-shirt, when I looked at her t-shirt, I thought, I'm going to make this sociopath view herself as almost like a superhero. And then, of course, that's when my motherly instincts came into play. And I thought, well, what kind of evil can she rid herself of? And I thought, men who prey on children, perfect, you know? And it just went from there. It was all downhill.
Wow. Okay, so you've mentioned in your writing room.
Yes.
So what is your routine? What is it like for you to write? Do you, obviously you have a writing room. Is there a time of day you like to write? Is there a mood you need to set to write?
You know, well, let me kind of give you a little description. Basically, it's a room that's way in the back of at my house, a lot of windows. And I enjoy, you know, just sitting in there. I also, you know, I can really write anywhere. I do a lot of traveling, so whether it's in the hotel or, you know, anywhere. But that would probably be my favorite place to write is in there. And my routine is usually I get up in the morning. We have a couple of lovely ladies that work for us, and they bring me my coffee. I have my coffee early in the morning. I try to work out. And I'm usually in there by 9 a.m., and I try to stay in there till 5, so I really view it as a job. And I really, like I said, for me, I really get lost in my own mind. It's almost when I'm writing like that all day long, I feel like I'm in a dream state, and I'm so deep in my own thoughts and in my own head that when I come out in the evening, because I do fix dinner for my husband, you know, it's like you know, waking up out of a dream.
Okay, so
it's very strange. I don't know. That's just the way it works.
You mentioned that you were in your writing room thinking about this novel when this neighbor went by. So
Yes. This
leads to my next question. When you're writing fiction like this, do you know where the story is going or how it's panning out before you start writing, or do you learn the story along with the writing?
Well, this is what happens for me is I have, I have 6 outlines right now on different stories. And what happens is I'll get a general idea, and I'll do an outline. So I basically have an idea of the type of story that I want to write and where it's going to go. But every day when I sit down, once I get my characters developed or give birth to them, I have an idea of where I want the story to go. But a lot of times, the characters will take me on a different path. And I just get so into it that it can always change. And that's kind of how I do it. But yes, I do have an outline. I do have a general idea on how I want the story to progress and so forth. But it can always change.
How much of your writing talent is affected by the lineage that you come from, and how much is affected by your educational background of journalism and marketing?
Well, I would have to say the types of story that I write, the marketing background definitely comes into play, because I really try to give the readers a little bit of everything in my writing. And it makes it more fun for me and more interesting as well, because I live a pretty, you know, quiet life. I mean, I have 2 children, husband, you know, a dog, a cat, you know, very basic. I'm cleaning hair out of the vacuum hose some days and, you know, all that stuff, what everyone else does. But so it is a lot of fun to write that way. I definitely think, and for me, it is very, very natural. It's definitely in my blood. There's no doubt about it. And it comes very easy. And writing is actually more easy for me sometimes than talking about it. Does that make sense? I mean,
Yep. When
I was younger, I had speech classes. You know, I was the child that didn't pronunciate her words as well as what she should have. Compared to my writing, it just flows. So I think it definitely is hereditary. There's no doubt about it. There's something in the genes there.
Now, you've chosen to donate a portion of all the sales for Once Wicked, Always Dead to the Shriners Hospitals for Children, correct?
Absolutely. I'm so excited about that, and I'm so fortunate that I'm able to do that, yes.
What led to this decision?
You know, when I decided that I was going to start my career now in writing, and which I'll be around for a very long time, as long as I possibly can, I knew that it's really important to give back, and I'm a big one for charities and good causes. And the Shriners, I know that the money that gets taken in, of course, really goes to the cause, and that was a big thing for me. And being a mother, and I love children, you know, it just was just a simple thing, a simple choice for me. So I'm just very blessed in my life, and blessed to have healthy children. So I'm just very excited about that. And besides, my husband is a Shriner as well. So it was, you know, I know more about that charity, and it was just an easy decision.
The new book is called Once Wicked, Always Dead. And tell us again a little bit about, I mean, I touched on the fact that there is a psychopath, but give us a little bit of a synopsis of the story.
Well, so much more. The main character, Molly Madison, you know, of course she's unaware of the sociopath who's loose. And this sociopath is creating havoc with his own sense of justice. And her life, Molly Madison's life, is shattered by the sudden death of her parents after the revelation of her husband Philip's affair. And, of course, it's with another man. So Molly leaves the city life and the country clubs and high society in Florida, and she heads west out to Montana. And she's going to take over the family business, so she's going to run that ranch and move on with her life. And, of course, there's a dreamy, handsome cowboy by the name of Clayton Leatherby, who's the ranch foreman, and her attraction to him is instant. But before their romance can really get going, the ranch falls prey to sabotage by some land developers who are not happy about Molly being a female and wants to run her off and take over. So Clayton learns of a family secret as well, and basically everyone collides with the sociopath. And it really puts Molly's life in jeopardy.
Again,
so that gives you a little brief synopsis of it.
There you go. Again, Once Wicked, Always Dead. It's written by T. Marie Benchley. And people can check out your website, correct, at tmariebenchley.com?
Oh. Yep, absolutely, tmariebenchley.com. All the icons are on there, so they can actually go right in there and do price checks and so forth.
And there's also very important, there's also links on your website to the Shriners Hospital.
Yes, absolutely. Go in there and check them out. And anyone who has a child who, you know, is a burn victim or orthopedic, please go in there. They're happy to take them right in for absolutely nothing, and they pay all the medical expenses. So it's a great, great organization.
T. Marie, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Oh, you're welcome, Peter, and thank you so much for having me on.
T. Marie Benchley, author of Once Wicked, Always Dead. You can check out her website at tmariebenchley.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Just click on the What's On page for this show, which is number 0059, and you'll find links to T. Marie's website, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones. There's a check sitting on my desk right now with my name on it for $36.94, but I can't bring myself to cash it. I'll bet you've received checks like this too, and maybe you've even felt the same way. The check is a distribution payment I received along with thousands of other people who were part of a class action lawsuit I never heard of. Class action lawsuits like this have made a lot of lawyers rich, even when the people they claim to represent get only a few bucks, or, in many cases, lousy coupons that they'll never use. If you've received checks like this too, you might wonder whether the lawsuit was legitimate or not. Did the company really do anything wrong? Let's be fair, many good lawyers have a hard time figuring out if these class action lawsuits pass the smell test. Recently, John Stossel had a program on TV where lawyers debating both sides of this issue faced off, and it was pretty fascinating viewing. If you'd like to see that and learn more about how class action lawsuits often hurt more people than they help, go to my website at bobdirigojones.com.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nullman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, we do indeed have Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter. Hi, Stu.
Hey, Peter, remember, don't forget, a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose.
Okay, and you're telling me this because?
Well, because in this edition of Book Banter, I have a book, it's a mystery, but it deals with Gertrude Stein, who said that very famous repetitive saying, but a very, very legendary one, too.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it seems that over the past century or so, Peter, that the city of lights itself, Paris, France, Gay Paris, was the place to be for expatriates. So this was quite evident in the years immediately following World War I, when a group of writers, authors, playwrights, poets, and artists, known as the Lost Generation, made Paris their home not only as a refuge from the post-war harsh realities of their native countries, but as a place where their talents could develop and be nurtured. So these accidental Parisians were quite an impressive group. You had Ernest Hemingway, James Joyce, Sherwood Anderson, Ezra Pound, and Pablo Picasso. And in the center of this charmed circle, that's what they were called, was Gertrude Stein, the eccentric, complex American-born author who was known art collector and had a keen eye for up-and-coming talent, whether it be someone with a pen or a paintbrush. And her Saturday night gatherings at her 27 Rue de Fleurieu home, she hosted with her longtime partner Alice B. Toklas, were seen as an important meeting of the minds in a social setting, and an invitation to those gatherings meant it was a means of acceptance to this charmed circle. And most importantly, an endorsement of a novel or painting by Stein carried a great deal of clout and could mean a long, successful, influential career. Now, the world of Paris in the 1920s has been a longtime passion for Arnie Greenberg. He's a retired Montreal-area college professor who taught a humanities class on the subject at Vanier College, which I happened to catch that class when I was a student there. So he taught that class for many years. And he's written extensively about the Lost Generation in Paris, and Stein in particular, and has conducted tours that revisited the world of Gertrude Stein's Paris during the 1920s. Now, Greenberg has taken his subject of expertise to another level, and this time in the form of a novel called Twice Deceived. Now, although Gertrude Stein plays a central role in the plot of the novel, it actually centers around Robert Haas, a real-life Montreal native who moved to Paris in the early 20s to try and launch his career as a painter. Now, thanks to an introduction by Sylvia Beach, the legendary owner of Shakespeare & Company bookstore, which still exists in Paris, Haas gets a meeting with Stein at her Paris domicile, and as a result, a friendship is immediately established between the two, and Stein becomes a bona fide supporter of Haas's work and pays him the ultimate compliment. She actually buys one of his paintings, much to his surprise. The door is finally open to Haas and is accepted into Stein's charmed circle, where he meets not only Hemingway, but also Henri Matisse and Pablo Picasso, whose 1906 portrait of Stein helped usher in the Cubist artistic movement that Picasso pioneered. Now, it's that much-regarded portrait that Haas helps Stein undergo an unusual artistic commission. He gets Marevna Vorobyev, a female Russian painter living in Paris, who made a reputation for herself as a master copier of famous paintings, a commission from Stein to paint a copy of that famous Picasso portrait. Now, the reason being is that Stein doesn't have to go traveling, throughout to her villa in the countryside and lug that big, heavy portrait. So that way she could have a copy hanging in her Paris villa and also in her apartment. The story then flashes forward to 1947, a year following Stein's death, and the portrait is about to be given to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. So when the painting is being authenticated, the story of Merevna's copy services. Now, Hannes is recruited to help the museum's personnel with the authentication before the painting's displayed in the museum. So he decides to go to the source and brings both paintings to Picasso. Now, however, the famous Spanish painter springs a surprise on Hass. Both paintings are copies.
Ooh.
So that's right. So where is the actual 1906 Gertrude Stein portrait, which practically began one of modern art's greatest periods of creativity? It has to be somewhere. Where is it? So Arne Greenberg shows through the book his passion and vast knowledge of the lost generation in Paris and its people, and this carefree world and the coterie of artists, writers, and eccentrics come back to life with so much vividness. Even the real-life figures who pop up in the story but are not widely known with today's generation make for fascinating reading. So in the second part of the book, which deals with the fictionalized mystery of the copied Stein portrait, is interesting to read and shows that Greenberg can weave a good mystery narrative that could practically read like a piece of factual storytelling. Twice Deceived is an entertaining mystery wrapped in a history, and although a fictionalized story about an actual painting can make a good story, it doubles as a portrait of a romanticized part of modern history that was Paris and the Lost Generation. So it's called Twice Deceived by Arne Greenberg, published by Eloquent Books, and it's $13.95.
Interesting concept. There's another book, and it's the title escapes me right now. Maybe you know of it. There's a fellow who has written Sherlock Holmes as a teenager.
Oh, really? It must be, I think, a series of young adult books, if I'm not...
Yes, exactly. And it's interesting taking, I mean, in both cases, I mean, that is a fictional character, but it's a fictional character that has come to life so many times that we seem to know Sherlock Holmes. So someone taking that story and basically giving a backstory to Sherlock Holmes is kind of interesting.
Oh, it certainly is. And you know what? If you like The Lost Generation or you want to read more about this fascinating period and these fascinating group of people, a couple books I have to suggest. One is Ernest Hemingway's A Movable Feast, which was one of the last books that was published by Hemingway. It was published in 1964, posthumously, which was his intimate account of his life, his short time in Paris, with hanging around with Gertrude Stein and Picasso and Henri Matisse. And also a book that was called Charm Circle by James R. Mello, which I was introduced to when I was taking this course in Vanier College, and is the definitive history of Gertrude Stein and her circle of friends during that period. So these two books are really well recommended, and I do highly suggest if you want to know about this little-known history of the 1920s, these are the two books you got to read.
Great stuff indeed. And how can people find out more information about what you do, Stuart?
Well, you can read me every week in the West End Times, either on paper or online at www.westendtimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart. Stuart Nolman and Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we have more stuff from said Stuff File, so let's get right to it. In Lando Lakes, Florida, 66-year-old David Kilpatrick apparently wanted a word with the school bus driver he felt was driving too fast through his neighborhood. So to get his attention, he took the subtle approach by throwing a heavy metal object right through the bus's windshield. More than 50 students and the bus driver were on board at the time, but no injuries were reported. While police wouldn't identify exactly what the object he threw was, Kilpatrick was arrested and charged with throwing a deadly missile and criminal mischief. Nice going there, pal. In Denver, Denver firefighters ran into more than the normal hazards of a house fire. Crews responded to a blaze and also had to battle bed bugs, the blood-sucking insects quickly becoming the scourge of households and businesses across the United States. Lieutenant Phil Champagne of the Denver Fire Department says that firefighters had to be decontaminated after going into an attic where items were infested with the bedbugs. The bugs scurried away from the flames and latched onto the firefighters' equipment and gear. Some of the gear had to be bagged so that the bugs wouldn't get a free ride to the firehouse. There were no injuries, but the home was declared uninhabitable. Something tells me it was uninhabitable before that fire started. Elsewhere, a woman stepped into a taco joint in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and told the clerk behind the counter, "I want a soft shell, and this is a stick-up. Give me all your money." But the robbery was foiled due to the woman's drunkenness. Or maybe it was because she couldn't get her weapon, a hammer, out of her waistband because her belly was in the way. The robber was obviously pregnant, the clerk noted. The robber ran, but police arrested Julie Bailey, age 38, after a short foot pursuit. By the time she was captured, she had the hammer in her hand. Police say she needed the money from the robbery to buy drugs. Ooh. No doubt she then complained that having to wear handcuffs might hurt the baby. There's a mother of the year of the future, don't you think? In Greensboro, North Carolina, police arrested 22-year-old Bradley Michael for breaking into a Red Lobster restaurant where he apparently went on a rampage. He allegedly broke through the front door and then destroyed an estimated $30,000 worth of computers, benches, and liquor bottles. But before leaving, he took the time to make himself a shrimp pizza and ate some cake, too. Officers found Michael sitting inside the restaurant where they arrested him and charged him with felony, breaking, and entering. And three friends in Whitehall, Pennsylvania, wrapped a fourth in plastic to videotape a stunt to post online. They dropped the wrapped boy off in a Kmart parking lot, waited for people to notice him, and then drove up, threw him in the trunk, and drove off again. "I thought it was obvious we were just goofing around," said Aaron D. Kutumas, who will be a high school senior this fall. But a waitress called the cops, thinking it was all a kidnapping. Within minutes, their car was surrounded by police cruisers, and the boys found themselves at gunpoint. "It's a joke! It's a joke!" called a muffled voice from the trunk. Unamused, officers charged all four boys with disorderly conduct. As for the video, it's not coming to a website near you anytime too soon. You see, since all four boys wanted to be in the video, none of them would hold the camera, and thus none of the action was recorded. Again, these boys, very dangerously close to being the idiots of the day, but they're not. This is the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I'll present, the idiot of the day.
Three men may be wishing they'd thought of a better hiding place when they led police on a foot chase straight to their marijuana warehouse. Mendocino County Sheriff's Captain Kirk Smallcomb said officers seized 700 pounds of processed pot and arrested 19 people at the marijuana operation in California. The chase began when the men were spotted in what police believe was a stolen car filled with marijuana. Smallcomb said officers arrived to find the 1,800-square-foot industrial building filled with drying plants and processed marijuana. The suspects range in age from 19 to 67 and are mostly Mendocino County residents. The Department of Homeland Security has placed immigration holds on several of the suspects. Okay, so let me get this straight. You're doing something illegal, which is basically cultivating, growing, selling, preparing marijuana. You are spotted by the police. So in your infinite wisdom, you decide you're going to hightail it with police fully in pursuit back to the place that is your headquarters or lair, where all together there are 16 more of you waiting to be arrested. I'm sure the 16 who were inside the place, to be joined by the other three, making a grand total of 19 to be arrested, were very happy that those three clowns came bursting in the doors with the police in hot pursuit. I'm sure when they all get to jail together, they'll have some good laughs about it. But in the meantime, those three guys, leading the cops directly to the other 16, so that they could all be arrested for marijuana possession and for pot selling? Well, those three guys are just simply idiots.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, number 0059. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that number is 0059. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com, or you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/PA Holder, or Twitter at twitter.com/PA Holder. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJMedia.com, aboard Taiwan's national carrier China Airlines for their long-haul Dynasty flights, and over the air at World FM 88.2 in New Zealand and Gold FM 90.5 in Singapore. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.